I don't know if you guys are like me. I don't know if you're like me, waiting to hear me talk the way I was waiting to hear Rodney talk. But when Rodney was going to give a Dhamma talk, I just could feel this aliveness with expectation and wonderment about whatever. I never cared what he was going to talk about. Just this sense of getting ready to hear the Dhamma. And there's something about Dhamma for practitioners that's electrifying in however we hear it. And I think that we could not even say that we were exploring the Dhamma if we were not willing to talk about death. We couldn't even, I mean, death is so central, a part of the Buddha Dhamma, that absent a conversation about it, I don't know that you can say that you're really contemplating the Dhamma. And equally, we can't talk about Dhamma in everyday life without talking about death. And it's particularly poignant in this time because it's about last year, this time is when I left the retreat. It would have been in March. And if someone had came to me and told me how many yogis, how many practitioners would tell me that they lost someone close to them because of the pandemic, if someone had said it would be more than you could count, I would have said, no, not going to be like that. But no, I have stopped counting how many yogis have told me that they lost somebody close because of COVID. I just don't even count anymore. And there's something about that that is telling, as part of our practice, being lay yogis in everyday life. So this convergence of death around our everyday life and around the Buddha Dhamma, it's a necessary place to be. And we did it, we put this in May, Tim and I, because Memorial Day weekend is at the end of the month, and somehow I'm gonna have a ceremony on that last Monday of the month. I don't know what kind of ceremony it's going to be right now, but it's going to be ceremonial. I know that. Some kind of ritual for us to really try to take in this idea of death in relation to Dhamma, in relation to being human. Tonight, I want to talk a little bit about the generalization of death. I guess you could say the themes that center around death. And we'll contemplate this for a couple of weeks, and then in the third week, we'll talk about specific practices I think that really helps us connect with Dhamma. I mean, connect with death around Dhamma, and we'll do that for a couple of weeks, and then we'll have our ceremony, some type of ceremony. That's the way I think the month will go. So, to throw it out there on the biggest edge of Dhamma, for someone to be awakened, it is referred to that they have somehow entered the deathless. So Buddha entered the deathless. But if I'm not mistaken, he died. There's this thing about deathless and someone dying. And I think Tanisaro Bhikkhu kind of points out what this is. He says, insight begins with a question that evaluates change in light of the desires for true happiness. It ends with a happiness that lies beyond change. So when we talk about the deathless in relation to Dhamma, we are talking about happiness that arises beyond this nature of change. And I'd like to talk about this idea of deathless from the concept of it itself from Buddhist life, the concept of it from impermanence, and then maybe the concept of it from our own human demise. It's very real. So from Buddha's life, we've all kind of heard this story about Buddha dying. And I just want to slow it down, sort of like ever since I've read Mary Oliver's poem, I keep like moving it down into this very, very micro sense of this grasshopper. Not who made grasshoppers, who made this grasshopper? And if you narrow that period in Buddha's life when he was dying down, there's some things you can see with a little bit more clarity. Just like the way Mary Oliver could see the chewing left to right instead of up and down, and the wiping the face and the flicking the wings to leave, the way she got in detail, there's a way we could kind of see that with the Buddha. So I think when the Buddha was dying, I always say he was dying. That's not the way the text actually write it out like that, but I just say that. Because his degree of renunciation had brought him to a point where he only ate a grain of rice a day. And he said that he could poke his finger through his belly button and touch his spine in the back. That he was so thin and so weak from not eating and his just renunciation practice. That, in my mind, sounds like dying, withering away. And in the course of his withering away, I think he was a strong practitioner nonetheless. So he was not practicing to stay alive. He was practicing to understand the nature of suffering. That was the point of it. So I want to understand the nature of suffering and not be led around by suffering. So if suffering is happening, I don't want to be led around by it. But we all have bodies. So we can see there was some pain there. There was some discomfort. There was some, you can't lay around on the ground wasting away barely a body and not have some pain. And to be conscious of that pain, but as a practitioner, I think he was just practicing with it. And in the midst of this practicing, he had this memory of a moment when he was a child and he was in samadhi, in the world and in samadhi. And that memory, I do not think was regret or, kind of like sadness, disappointment. I think that memory was inspiration in the in his hour of dying, he got inspired by a memory. And I think it was inspiration because in the contemplating and letting this memory just unfold, what came to him was the thought, might there be another way? Might there be another way? Another way to approach this lifelong goal of trying to end his suffering, come to an understanding that released him from suffering. So in that moment, he thought, might there be another way? I just don't, that does not feel like remorse. It doesn't feel like giving up. Like, oh, this isn't working. I need to try something else. That feels like that moment was a moment of continuation on a path. A continuation, a going beyond where he was at that moment, going beyond that. And so, as the story would have it, a woman came along and helped him, saw that he really needed something to eat and helped him. And in the midst of him being helped, his friends left him because they thought he had given up. Everybody that would probably look at him would say, oh, he gave up. He didn't go all the way and he quit. And started eating again. But when he got his strength back, what the Buddha began to look into was just this. And the more you read the suttas of the way that he explains this process, the more you see that it was not just the practice. It was not some ritual, and it was not some kind of teachings. There were no teachings on what it was he was doing. So the only thing he had, he didn't have his friends, he didn't have any money, he had his strength, he had his mind, and he had this interest, this intention or inspiration to go beyond. That's what he had. And in that, he just kept turning to just this, just this, just this, just this, just this. So out of all the things that I think Buddha could have seen, what he actually saw was impermanence. He didn't see, you know, I don't know, you guys, we've all had those moments of insight that comes to us, and we're like, oh, I'm not so bad after all. Or we have some moment where we realize, oh, I just keep pushing against this, and I really should just let it go. I mean, we have all these insights after insights after insights as practitioners. I remember the first time I realized I did not have to hold my shoulders up. I could barely sit through the entire 40-minute sit. It was at Sims. Sit through the entire 40-minute sit and Rodney's Dhamma talk that I wasn't even listening to, just to get up there for the 2 minutes to tell him I relaxed my shoulders. Was that big of a deal? But when the Buddha, when he was practicing, what he saw was impermanence. And I'm hoping I can talk a little bit about why beginning to look for impermanence becomes so important. It's not just something we do. It's the whole of the point behind the practice. And in Buddha's willingness to just this, see impermanence, he moved beyond the realm of change, beyond the realm of impermanence. He moved beyond the realm of the death and moved into the world of the deathless. It seems strange, given that he died. And if Buddha were here, he would certainly say, no, I'm not going to heaven. No, I'm not going to hell. No, I'm not going to some other place. You know, because we have a tendency in our culture, just like in the culture that Buddha was in, to say that the deathless must mean that my body, my meanness continues on into something. Or there were people, just like in this time, who believed nothing. Neither one. No, you're just gone. That's it. So nothing's going to happen to you. And Buddha did not subscribe to either one of those extremes. He wouldn't tell you what he did believe in, what he knew, not a belief even, because the Buddha knew so much once his mind awakened. It's not, he didn't even have to tell you what he did believe. For there are so many suttas where people would come to him and ask him, so do we live after, do we live after death? He'd say, that's irrelevant. That's a foolish question. There's no answer for that. People would say, what? Do we not live after death? No, that's a foolish question. I'm not going to talk about that. He wouldn't talk about that. They'd say, okay, well, what about you? You're an awakened being trying to get an in run around, right? So you live after death, right? He wouldn't answer that. He'd say it was irrelevant. Do you not? Do you both exist and not exist? He'd say that's irrelevant. Wouldn't even talk about it. So he never would talk about these things. And yet, he would tell people about practicing in the here and now, in the here and now, in the here and now. Keep saying that. In the here and now, in the here and now, in the here and now. He kept talking about death and the endings of things. But yet he wouldn't say what happens. He just talked about the inevitable suffering of attachment and change. The inevitable suffering of attachment and change. There's a really nice sutta. I think I've pointed to this one before, but some of these suttas, they're so beautiful. I point to them all the time. But there's really this one beautiful sutta where the Buddha's giving a talk. I think he's giving a talk to a group of householders. I tried to find it, but I didn't have enough time, so maybe I'll find it between now and next week. But he's talking to a group of householders. And in this talk, he picks up a flower off the ground. And he just holds it up. And so there are all these people that are like, oh, like it's so profound. But one householder in the back of the monastery starts laughing. And the Buddha points him out and says, oh, householder so-and-so, he understands. He understands that, you know, the flower, it rose and it will pass away. Whatever arises is going to pass away. Whatever arises is going to pass away. There's another sutta where after the Buddha was awakened and he, you know, spent a lot of time with the tree and the place and came to terms with the fact that he was going to teach, the group of people he wanted to go teach to were the guys that left him in the first place. And I think I heard somewhere that he traveled like 200 miles just to go and find them and meet them and give them this Dhamma talk. And when he gave the Dhamma talk, again, one of these five friends of his understood whatever rises ceases. Whatever arises passes away. And when that person understood that, that person got enlightened. And there's a section in that sutta when the Buddha is giving this talk to his friends where it said that the spirit world at the level right above our human existence, they were listening to Buddha's Dhamma talk and they yelled up to the spirits above them that the wheel of the Dhamma had started turning. And that level yelled up to the spirits above them. I just think about that because I'm hoping that I can explain this in such a way for the magnitude of what the Buddha had done when he told his friends about what he saw. And he told it freely. And the wheel of Dhamma had turned. Not because he somehow understood the breath. He didn't understand conceptually what is karma, what is not karma. He didn't, in none of that. What he saw was the immediacy of impermanence and the liberative quality that comes from learning to be with up close and personal impermanence. That's what I think he saw. That's what I think the rest of his teaching, all the years that he taught, and all of his saying, I teach about suffering and the end of suffering, what he was teaching over and over and over is, I teach about impermanence. I teach about impermanence. Some way or another, this is about impermanence. And the sooner we can come to a place with it, the sooner we can let go of all the suffering that comes from the expectancy of permanency. So everything that arises passes away. Everything. On one level, this is quite disruptive to our human existence. This is quite painful, and it gets very destabilizing, and it's like it uproots everything that we hold to be dear, because people in our lives die. We lose our jobs, marriages that we thought were going to be forever end. And when they end, we can't even speak to each other. I don't even want to be in the same room with you. I never could have possibly loved you as much as I hate you right now. I mean, everything in our world ends, and the ending is usually disruptive, destabilizing. And yet, it is. We have lived with it our entire lives. I mean, babies live with it. They get their bottle. They're so happy. They can't even, they're just happy. Just swaddle me up. Give me a burp. Put me down. Go away. I'm good. Yeah, but we know they're only good for like an hour and a half. And then they're going to be back in the same disruption. It's constant. This ending and beginning and ending and beginning and ending and beginning and ending, 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 beginning, beginning, beginning. It's constant. And this is what I think the Buddha saw so much. So when he started teaching, his teaching was not pointing to how do I deal with this constant ending? How do I deal with impermanence? Because it's all around me. Those are the kind of questions we ask. I mean, I can remember all the questions I used to ask Rodney or when I was on retreat. It was all about, how do I deal with all this? How can I make it better so I don't feel so bad because everything is ending and things are not staying the way? How can I make my sit today like it was yesterday? How can I somehow or another learn how to do it so it stays the same and it's always good and I like it? When it's worth it. Because it's only worth it if it stays good all the time. If it's constantly moving, shifting, changing, rearranging, we don't even want it. Think about when you first started practicing, trying to follow the breath. That's what all the teachers say. Okay, I'm going to try to do that. And how many of you thought, this is stupid. This is boring. This is a waste of time because it changes all the time. But once we started having those sits that were, the breath was steadier, started enjoying it, pleasant. I can stay with the breath. Now we're walking around. Everybody loves the practice. Love it. Now what the Buddha was pointing to is the love it, needs to come with the inconsistency, with the disruption, the not staying the same, the changes, the loss, the starting again, all of that energy is what I think the Buddha was trying to point to. He pointed to it in dependent origination. We spent an entire year on all of the constant disruption, all the way to suffering, and then start all over again. He pointed to it in the three characteristics and told us just straight out, life is impermanent. And that impermanent caused dissatisfaction. And that dissatisfaction, we, as long as we personalize it, we are going to suffer. He has pointed to it in the way he said, establish the foundations of mindfulness in the Satipatthana and in the Anapanasati. Both of those suttas are basically pointing to the noticing of the arising and passing away of the breath. The arising and passing away of the breath. Rising and passing away of the breath. So a lot of us, including myself, we begin to practice with the notion that if I notice the arising and passing away, if I start noticing the impermanent nature of things, things come and go, okay, I'm just going to be with it because things come and go, and that's just the way it is. That's how I'm going to be good with it, is because it comes and goes. What can you do? And we begin to work on somehow or another mentally finding satisfaction in the, it's okay that it comes and goes. And I think that misses what Buddha was pointing to. I think he was pointing to the dissatisfaction of the coming and going and being willing to not smooth out the rough edges. Don't smooth it out so you don't even notice that impermanence is difficult. Instead, I think he wanted to see the impermanence all by itself. That became his point. Can you just see impermanence without it having to be good or bad? It's in the knowing. There's a sutta where he talks about impermanence, and they were asking, what's the distinction between someone who, he used the vicissitudes or the eight worldly winds. So he used the notion that In impermanence, it means that there's going to be gain and there's going to be loss. It's going to be gain and loss. Not that I'm going to be okay with the loss. Loss, not okay. Gain, okay. Gain and loss. There's going to be pleasure and pain. There's going to be fame and ill repute. And I like the way Philip points to it is, meaning that everybody in your family and everybody in your world, they like you, like you, like you. And then there's a time when nobody seems to like you. Family, you're getting on everybody in the family's nerves, the people around you at your job, everybody's whispering about you. That is ill repute. That doesn't mean, oh, everybody thinks you're a liar, a cheat, or some terrible thing like that, but just that you seem to be on the outs with people. And then there's praise and blame. People singing your praises, people grumbling about everything you do. So Buddha was saying that that happens all the time, all the time, all the time. The distinction that he brought out is not between a practitioner and just an ordinary person, is not how they deal with the, well, let me just tell you the distinction first. So the distinction is that when a person of ordinary worldly sense, non-practitioner, comes to gain, then they welcome it. They're like, yes, bring it on. Good stuff happening to me. Something bad happens, the loss, then they rebel against any kind of loss. So they rebel against the loss or the blame or the ill repute or the pain. And then they welcome and lavish any kind of gain, any kind of pleasure, any kind of praise or fame. That's the way we live. I live that way. I'm forever checking that. But that's the way we live. So a strong practitioner, what the Buddha said, does not welcome the good and doesn't rebel against the bad. That, for many practitioners, sounds like, I don't care. I'm just with it. And I don't think that's what he was pointing to. I think he was pointing to, it's more important that you know gain is coming and it's not going to stay. Loss is pretty much on the heels of it. They may be here, but ill repute coming around the corner. There's a knowingness that whatever gain comes is inconsistent. It's not permanent. It's subject to change. By knowing that gain comes forward and followed, that even when loss comes, there's a knowing that gain comes also. I think the best way I've ever heard this explained was an interview by Ajahn Amaro, who was the abbot in England's monastery at the time. And I've never been there. But I'm assuming from what the interviewer said, it must be pretty nice for anybody that has been there. And so the interviewer, Ajahn Amaro, was talking about how, you know, a monastic's life is in the center, in the middle, just whatever, just this, just this, just this, just this. And the interviewer said something to the effect of, yeah, that sounds great for you guys because you live in this really, really gorgeous monastery. And Ajahn Amaro didn't even skip a beat. He just said, well, for a layperson or non-practitioner, you think this is a game. You have something. But for a monastic, it can be taken away from us. I would be just as happy if I was packing up my bag and I was walking off somewhere and don't know where I'm going as I am here. That this just happens to be where I am right now. There's a way in which practice is pointing us all to live in that kind of a mode. Not just, are we monastics or are we not? We are learning to live in the mode that allows life in its ever-changing way to not fight against it. Not to not respond to it. So if something happens, you'd have to respond, but you don't have to fight against what it is that you have to respond to. I think when we learn how to be with impermanence, which we're going to talk about way more practicing with this in the second half of the month, but this idea of learning how to, instead of move through life fixing and solving the vicissitudes of life, and instead noticing this coming and going that's happening, that is where I think our practice turns, is when we can learn to notice this as gain and loss, impermanence, the nature of things. Then I think our practice begins to turn. But all of this, I think, is pointing towards the final part, which is death. I think it's all pointing towards death. I think it's pointing towards our human body demise. And the reason why I think it's pointing towards our human body demise has to do with an understanding that the closer you get to a willingness to understand and respect death. In fact, this is what my son said to me yesterday. For some of you may not know, but he has pancreatic cancer, stage 4. He was only given a year to live last year, so he's already outlived his days. But yesterday we were walking and talking, and he said that when he got this diagnosis, at first he was just like in the depths of, you know, okay, whatever, I'm just going to live out my life until I die, and then that's it. I'm just going to go when it's time to go. And then he said, and then something hit me, wait a minute. If I only have a year to live, I'm doing what I want to do. I'm living the way I want to live. I'm doing what I need to do. I mean, it was just this kind of like, all of a sudden, what he actually said was, fuck it. I'm living the way I want to live. I don't care. And there was this upbeat joy in his voice. Because when you come to this understanding of the reality of death, then what you're left with is the reality of your human life right here. Just this. So there's a story I want to tell you. I don't have time to read the whole story, so which is a bummer, but I'll tell you what it is. So this story, you may know the story, but there's a story where a man dies, a person dies, doesn't have to be a man. Some person died, and they had been misbehaving their whole lifetime. They found themselves reborn in hell. And so they were standing before the king of death. And the king is questioning him and said, good man, did you not see the three divine messengers that appeared among the human beings? And the man says, no, Lord, I didn't see them. He says, oh. But did you ever among your life see a man or woman 80, 90, or 100 years of age, frail, bent like a roof bracelet, crooked, wobbly as they go along, leaning on a stick, ailing, youth gone, with broken teeth, with gray and scanty hair, or bald, with wrinkled skin and blotched himself, blotched limbs? Or did you ever see a man or woman sick, afflicted, gravely ill, lying in their own urine or excrement, having to be lifted up or by some or pulled down by others? Or a man or woman or a person, 1 or 2 or 3 days dead, the corpse bloated, livid, and festering? The man replied, yes, Lord, I've seen this. The king of death says, well, good man, did it not occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, I too am subject to old age, illness, and death. I am not exempt from old age, illness, and death. Let me now do good by body, speech, and mind. No, Lord, I could not. I was heedless. And so the king went on to tell him, well, your heedlessness is what got you here. It wasn't your mama, your daddy. It wasn't none of your peoples. It wasn't none of the boss down the street. List all these people. You're here because of your own heedlessness. And I think this story existed at the time of the Buddha. So when we hear all these stories about the Buddha seeing old age, sickness, and death, Philip one time said that what Buddha was struck by was not the fact that somebody was old or sick or dying, which is the way I always process that story. Like, oh, the Buddha was kept protected so much so that he goes outside and finally sees a sick person, finally sees somebody that's old, finally sees someone that died. But that's not what Philip said. What Philip said, what bothered Buddha, was he couldn't understand why he would turn away from looking at something that he himself was going to go through. So why do I turn away from looking at someone who's old or sickly or dead? Why do I turn away? There's no point in that. That is what prompted the Buddha to go out on this long quest, and that is what he began to look for towards his awakening. And I think what he's pointing back to the rest of us is, if you are willing to begin to look at the truth of death, the truth that we as human beings are all going to die, that somehow it's all, the body is going to go, that the more we look at our own demise and the reality of death, the more willing we would be to pay attention to what it is that we're doing in our life right now, just this moment. Because the preciousness of life itself, we would no longer want to waste. That our life would begin to be in this moment, I don't want to waste it. So I think what he ultimately realized back when he was about to die and he thought this, might there be another way? I think that's what he realized. That, is this it? Do I just die and that's it? Or is there some other way, some other relationship I could have with life and in that relationship free myself from death? And that's what I think he did. He freed himself from being subject to the harshness of change. And change can just be however it is. So I want to end with a poem by Donna Markova, I think it is. Markova. That's what Donna says. I will not die an unlived life. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days, to allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid, more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise, I choose to risk my significance to live so that which comes, to live so that which came to me as seed grows to the next as blossom. And that which came to me as blossom goes on as fruit. Until it becomes a wing. I want to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. I choose to risk my significance. That's it. I choose to risk my significance that is non-self. To live so that which came to me as seed goes on to the next as blossom. And that which came to me as blossom goes on as fruit. So let's sit a moment. I'll see if there's any questions or comments that people want to share. Carla?
Yeah, I just wanted to share a comment. You said something, Tweri, that that was really helpful for me. You said something to the effect, or at least I interpreted it through the lens of what I've been experiencing recently as allowing myself to experience impermanence and not try to control it out of my life, is actually giving myself the opportunity to have insight, right? And to see reality as it is. Especially lately, I've been observing my perfectionism a lot. And that comes with the tendency to, want to perfectly plan out my day. And then when something unexpected happens, the story is, oh, this is a waste of my time. I'm not using my time the most effective way I could, and so on and so forth, and I had never thought of it like that. I mean, I could identify the perfectionism as being, at odds with reality, but it was so helpful to hear you reframe it as allowing myself to actually experience the disruptions is giving myself the opportunity to gain insight, right? And to practice. So it's almost, if I'm following that train of thought of what's a good use of my time, it's actually a really beneficial use of my time to experience all those unexpected disruptions, because those are much better practice opportunities.
That's right. So, and they're going to come constantly, because it's always going to be disruptive. That's the whole point of it. So you're actually going to be happier for it, because the disruptions no longer show up as irritations. They show up as life, and your ability to be happier in life comes from the allowing of the disruption, and not even categorizing it as not disruptive. Oh, this is just something. This is just life. No. It's disruptive, but I'm letting that disruption be as it is. I don't repel against that which I dislike, and I don't welcome that which I like. So inherent in that liking inherent in the disruption is a don't like, but we're not going to repel against that disruption. We're going to let it be, so we can begin to see this is the nature of life. Especially thinking about death. Goodness, when death comes, in my family, it seems like it comes out of the blue. But in some people's family, there's long protracted deaths. But in ours, it's just like, that's it. So I don't know which is better. But I do know that it comes unexpectedly. It's not so controlled like that. And so if you learn to practice with unexpectedness, then the wisdom of that practice that you've been doing for your life helps you in the moment when ultimately the possibility of your own demise comes. And I think that was important to the Buddha because he believed in rebirth. And several times he said, you don't have to believe in rebirth, but that doesn't mean it's not real. And so I think he believed that if people could practice at the moment of their death without being so afraid, they wouldn't just impulsively, their energies go back into another continuation of more of the same, more of the same, more of the same. But I guess even if you don't believe in rebirth, every time you fight against interruption, you are sending yourself back into the possibility that the next interruption, you're going to have the same problem. And then the next interruption, you're going to have the same problem. And you're constantly fighting interruptions, not seeing that, no, interruption is the way life is. That's more in line with the way life is, not whether or not I can handle the interruption. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Deb.
Hi. I have a question about, this is one place where I get caught up in this subject, which is about, when you talk about handling the interruption and sort of allowing the interruption to really be there, not trying to gloss it over. And then I think about, how can I maintain equanimity at the same time that I'm handling? They seem to cancel. Sometimes it seems to me that they cancel one another out. If I'm equanimous, I'm just sailing, you know, oops, there's a little interruption. Ooh, you know, goes by. But you seem to be stressing, no, really feel the interruption. It's really, you know, it's really there. So really feel it. And how can I maintain equanimity at the same time of experiencing this interruption? That's my question.
That is such a beautiful question, Deb. You and Carla are hitting it right on the nail. Because if your thoughts of equanimity is this sense that things are good, flowing rightly, I'm okay with whatever it is, meaning that I have to be okay with the interruption. But if you're okay with the interruption, it's not really an interruption. It's kind of like we just kind of adjusted a little bit, smooth off the edges a bit. What I think is more true about life is that interruptions are challenging and difficult. Where we are to be equanimous is that it's okay that something is challenging and difficult. It's okay that anger would be arising, and I don't necessarily have to make everybody else angry because I'm angry. And I don't have to make that anger go away so I'm not angry. The idea is to begin to practice in such a way that you come to this place of just this. So if anger is arising, then anger is arising. And we turn our interest not in how do I get the anger to go away, but our interest in what is this anger anyway? Where does it come from? How does it come? How does it feel? What is it? We investigate the nature of that. And our equanimous energy, that equipoise that Venerable Nalio calls it, it arises not in the, there's no anger, so I'm equipoised. It comes in, it's okay that this is here. I want to just investigate it.
And I think, go
ahead.
So you go towards investigation instead of saying, oh, I'm angry, so this is a problem.
Yes.
I gotta quash this because it's a problem. And instead you say, well, I'm angry, but this is not a problem, but I can be curious about this anger.
That's right.
For instance. Okay.
That's it. I mean, I think what I was going to say was the way that Buddha described it in this sutta called the two thoughts. I always remind myself of this sutta for a long, long time until I begin to get much more steadier with being with what I didn't like and what was difficult. He gives this long discourse about how he divided his thoughts up. You know, thoughts on that were considered harmful, thoughts that were considered not harmful, thoughts he considered as not kind, thoughts that he considered were kind and towards goodwill, thoughts that he considered indulgent, and thoughts that he considered renunciate. And then he looked at the thoughts that he realized that the thoughts that he considered non-harm, that were harmful, not kind or caring and were indulgent, led to more and more and more suffering. So even if he dropped those, the ones over here that were kind and they were not harming and renunciate, if he dwelled too long on those, that got harmful. So he began to realize, I got to tighten it down, just, you know, be with these thoughts the way it is. The thing that struck me about that whole discourse is that's the first time I realized that Buddha was thinking through this whole process. He's having this meditative process and he's thinking through the process. He's looking at it, understanding it. So anger is not something that should be gotten rid of, gotten over. That is not something we do. That is something that the practice alone brings us to, that place where defilements no longer arise like with an arhat. Our job as practitioners, especially lay practitioners, where we're always around, like we talked about with wealth, that the Buddha said lay practitioners, the sense doors are our level of pleasure and happiness. So we're always going to be bumping up against these sense doors and running into, dislike and like. Our practice then becomes being interested in the nature of that arising that's here, knowing that it's going to pass away. At some point, you won't be angry. But in the moment that it's there, well, let's take a look at that and see what. How did it come? Can I stay with this anger until it passes? How many times do we have anger, think we're going to be angry forever, and then one day, or just, at some moment notice, I'm not angry anymore. We don't even know when it left, why it left, why it came. I mean, we can blame something, but sometimes that same thing could happen and I wouldn't be angry. And not everybody gets angry at that thing. How come I got angry? So there's this way in which we go through life assuming whatever's happening, we need to figure out how to make it nicer, more pleasant and pleasing. And I think that's not what the Buddha was saying. I think he was saying, as practitioners, we just want to get into the habit of looking at it, seeing it. Like, oh, okay. So here's your practice. So pick some emotion. Anger is the easy go-to one because we experience it all the time. But you might be experiencing isolation, loneliness, could be sadness, could be worry. That could be your go-to energy. Anxiety could be your go-to energy. And see what it would be like to, instead of trying to get rid of that emotion, that you wanted to stay with it until you notice it's in. It didn't matter how long it stays, whatever. Whatever it is, I just want to see it when it goes. I want to see it. And you can't stay with it in that sense of the story. Because if you stay with the story, it ain't never going nowhere. As long as you remember the story, it's going to hang around. So you really want to just see if you could feel the anxiety and how long will it last if there's no story, if I just try to feel the anxiety, try to feel this anger, how long does it last? On its own. You don't want to make it go away. You just want it to go on its own. Anyway, I better stop here. Thank you so much. Those were really great. That's perfect. Good way to begin to look into this whole death thing. And then next week we'll do a summary of this, and I'll have some practice questions for us to kind of contemplate. All right? All right. Thank you so much.